WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I wish I could control my memory. I wish I could remember all the new things I learned, that I would never again embarrass myself by forgetting the name of the person I just met. I wish I could forget some of the more miserable things that have happened to me. I know very little about how memory works, so I was interested in what Dr. Daniel Alcon is learning about it. Dr. Alcon is a pioneer in the field of memory and learning. He's chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health and a medical director of the United States Public Health Service. He's written a new book about his research called Memory's Voice, Deciphering the Mind-Brain Code. He's investigating how learning and memories leave an imprint on the brain. He began his research studying the neural networks of snails.
While I was a medical student, I kind of hatched these ideas as to how brain circuits would learn, and I decided that the only way I could test these ideas was by finding first a very simple wiring, such as might occur in a snail. And essentially what I looked for was what I called in my book evolution's compromise, a compromise between having a nervous system that was complex enough to learn memory such as relevant to our own experience, humans, but simple enough that we might be able to tease it apart in intricate detail. And the reason why that's so essential is that you have to think of the billions and billions of neurons in the human brain and the billions of wires, even almost infinite number of wires between these neurons, to realize how impossible and difficult it is to tease apart the actual paths of electrical signals in the human brain. We're starting to, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But in a snail, where you have only some thousands of neurons, we could use today's technology for essentially listening to these signals and trace the signals as they were actually learning a memory. And once we traced them, we could find the chemical changes that were actually storing the memory. Just as, for example, when we record a voice on a tape recorder, there are certain physical and chemical changes on that tape to store that voice. There are physical and chemical changes in the snail's brain, in a rabbit's brain, and in the human brain to store that memory.
Well, snails don't have memories of summer vacations and youthful romance. What kind of memory did you teach it so you could try to find how the memory was being stored?
Well, we began with a very simple associative memory, one described by Pavlov at the turn of the century. Pavlovian conditioning involves a dog, for example, learning to link the smell of meat with a sound of a bell that just occurs before it. In a way, the dog's salivation, every time it hears the sound, is like a measurable demonstration that inside the dog's brain a link has actually been formed to record, to make that tape recording of an association. So what we wanted to do is to find an association like Pavlov found with a dog in the snail. And once we found that association, we could look in much more complex associations, let's say in rabbits and hopefully in mammals as well, higher mammals and even humans, to see if the principles were the same.
So what were you able to actually see in the snail's brain? Do snails have brains? Am I using the right word?
Yes, it's fair.
Uh-huh. So were you actually able to watch the memory being stored?
Yes. Ultimately, we were able to watch it. And really, this was the first time that in the history of biology that it was possible to watch an association being formed as it was formed in a living brain system.
What did it look like?
Well, first, if you wanted to know what it looks like in the laboratory, you're looking at a screen, like a TV screen, only the screen is largely dark except a kind of very, very bright fluorescent trace, which kind of is constantly moving up and down in a certain pattern. So the first form of that memory is a pattern of signals on a fluorescent screen, which is changing as the snail learns to link, to associate a flash of light with being shaken about as if it were in the sea. It's a sea snail. And so you first see these fluorescent trace patterns changing. And then if you look in a little bit more detail at those neurons, you can start seeing that the flow of charged particles across the cells inside that brain are also changing. And then if you look even in a little more detail, which is even the most exciting level, you start to see the chemicals, the actual chemicals that are changing to allow this phosphorescent trace to give us these signal patterns.
So you were monitoring the brain on like a video screen?
Well, you can video record those. That's right. It's like a video screen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just to explain here, the Pavlovian type behavior you taught the snail was you'd show it a flash of light and then shake up the tube that it lived in. So the snail learned to associate that after it saw the light, it was going to get this rude shaking.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Daniel Alcon. He's the chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. And he's also the author of a new book about memory called Memory's Voice. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Daniel Alcon is my guest, author of a new book about research into memory called Memory's Voice. Now, what's the relevance of what you saw in the snail to the human brain?
Well, humans, first of all, can be Pavlovian conditioning, too. And in fact, most interesting to me is that some of the nature of traumatic conditioning involves emotional responses to certain stimuli. Some people, for example, who have suffered wartime stress may be all right for a while, and they suddenly see a certain situation, a town marketplace, which, let's say, they were bombed in or they were wounded in, and suddenly the entire experience from war flashes back. It's as if the situation in the marketplace was linked to that wartime experience.
Is there any kind of chemical or neurological comparison you can make between the snail and the human brain?
Well, that's what we're beginning to find encouragement for, that that the nature of these linkages is such that they involve chemicals not only in the snail but in mammals and humans that are virtually the same or very much very similar. And when, for example, an addict, even when he's or she is detoxified and the metabolic dependence is lost, sometimes you just show the paraphernalia to that individual, and there's the conditioning. The individual responds with the responses if the addictive substance were introduced or about to be introduced. It's the paraphernalia that just the image of that paraphernalia. Now, that brings on this condition, response, and expectation. And this is another example of linkage. The hope is that we will understand the chemicals involved in these linkages so well that not only will we be able to offer clinical help to such people, but ultimately we'll be able to image memories as they are being formed in a human brain. And we're beginning to do this with something called PET scanning and magnetic resonance imaging, various techniques which are going to explode in the next 20 years or so, which involve marking those chemicals, those same chemicals that we find are involved in memory storage. We can mark them, make tags for them, and then you can see an image of change throughout a brain structure as the memory is being laid down. And ultimately, you can imagine in the future that we might be able to actually watch memory in the human brain as someone is learning something.
You know, whenever I hear about remarkable possibilities like this, I always say to myself, well, would that be good or bad? Do we really want that? I mean, do we really want to be able to manipulate our memories?
It's a wonderful question, and it's an important question which doesn't have an easy answer. Obviously, there are some wonderful clinical possibilities that can emerge from these kinds of studies and with our new insights, as well as dangers. This kind of knowledge can be abused. When we understood nuclear energy, we unleashed nuclear war and the possibility of nuclear war. So one has to proceed, I think, with a certain amount of faith that more knowledge is better. I, I can't help but remember Margaret Mead's statement about this some years ago, where she said, "I proceed with the faith that knowing more is better for humanity, not worse." But it's more in the realm of faith. And insights on the cellular level, for example, about memory to combat mental disease, whether it's from child abuse or whether it's involved in depression or schizophrenia, however these insights lead us to new answers, don't solve the sociologic problems. They don't solve the legal problems. Just because you may come up with a conclusion that an abuse of a child is going to have profound impact, devastating impact on his or her life later on, doesn't allow you to go into the neighbor's house and say, "Stop doing that." It doesn't solve that problem. We still are plagued with an enormous number of situations where we know abuse is going on. We know that abusers tend to have more abusers as children. We know that it's bad, even without knowing all the cellular aspects, yet we don't have any answers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Alcon. He's the chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. Memory is of special interest to me because I'm always sure I'm losing mine. Why is it your subject?
Well, my interest in memory began really in my late adolescence when I became concerned and involved with a childhood friend, Michelle, as I call her in the book, who was suffering for some period of years from circumstances in her family that involved child abuse. And even back then, I came to a kind of conclusion or strong hypothesis that these experiences were going to have a profound effect on the rest of her life, and that this effect would be mediated by, depend on, the memories that were being formed, that were being laid down with these dreadful experiences.
Well, your friend Michelle ended up killing herself, so the memories not only haunted her, that you could say that they destroyed her. Generalize out of that about your interest in memory and why certain memories stick with us and others don't, and how memories make us who we are.
Well, of course, even in Michelle's case, whose story is a kind of a subtext for my book, the memories interacted with all of the other factors in her life, her genetic composition, her talents, her attributes. And it was the interaction not only of the memories with what she inherited, but it involved the interaction of Michelle with other people. And what fascinated me was that it's the relationships among people and the memories that we form about these relationships, some of which can be traumatic, whether it's due to physical sexual abuse or rape or post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's these memories which have later a profound impact on the rest of our lives, on the kinds of behavioral patterns that we follow.
You tell in your book how you lost consciousness during a gastric hemorrhage that you had. And I wonder what you remember about the experience and what you think you've been saved from remembering.
Well, most of all, I remembered that aside from the kind of review of my entire life, which rushed through my mind.
That really happened, huh?
It really happened. And there's no doubt in my mind that this is what happens to many people. It's a kind of a review of your life. Aside from that, there was an emotional experience which I have found to some extent almost a guide for the rest of the years that I have followed. And that is that as I was losing consciousness, as my life rushed before me, I felt the sense of relief and release from obligation. It was as if I knew that I could do nothing else. And this release was marvelously pleasant. And it gave me a kind of perspective that it's useful to return to in my everyday life, that it's useful sometimes, although you try very hard at certain times, to let yourself off the hook, to enjoy that release and recognize that sometimes choices won't work and it's time to just let it happen.
Why do you think your life flashes before you when you're threatened with losing your life?
I don't, of course, know, but I can suggest that it's the impending loss of all that you've experienced. It's the sense that you're going to lose it. For example, I remember thinking most, first of all, of my children and my wife, people most immediately important to me. I remember they flashed before me because these were what I was going to lose. And then I had this review of many other things in my life that I was going to lose. I think it's as if you are reviewing all of what you're about to lose. It's anticipating what you're about to lose. And that is the way memories actually serve us. They allow us to anticipate our future. And most of the time, it serves us well. And sometimes we have to work on them because it's keeping us trapped in the past.
Dr. Alcon, I thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Dr. Daniel Alcon is chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health and author of the new book, Memory's Voice. This is Fresh Air.